Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. As you know, we begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. He testified during the impeachment hearings of 2019. He not only assured his father that it would be okay, in a lot of ways, I think he was trying to remind the country that this is America. You can speak truth to power. And then what we know is that in 2020 of February, he and his brother were basically walked out of the White House. It's not been okay for him. It's not been okay for his brother. It's not okay for the country. Now the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So one of my favorite people on the planet is Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst, the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, a whistleblower at the CIA. I don't know how he has time to do all this. And his most recent book is called American Carnage, The Wars of Donald Trump. Mel, you wrote a piece at Counterpunch where you are one of the sort of key, I think, national security people at that site. It raised two things for me. First was a quote from a very famous Canadian known as Tommy Douglas. He's actually known as the father of Medicare in Canada. He had this quote about fascism, and I wanted to sort of read it to you. Once more, let me remind you what fascism is. It need not wear a brown shirt or a green shirt. It may even wear a dress shirt. Fascism begins the moment a ruling class, fearing the people may use their political democracy to gain economic democracy, begins to destroy political democracy in order to retain its power and special privilege. That's Tommy Douglas. Your piece at Counterpunch was kind of looking at what you said is maybe he's finally stepped over the line when it came to Donald Trump's use of the military. In your fabulous piece, which just it lays it out almost like you were using a GPS and you were saying, go here and then go here and then go here. And by the time you get done, you're exhausted. There was one paragraph in your piece that I wanted to begin with. Trump has managed to weaken most of the guardrails that protect our fragile democracy from authoritarian leanings. He has neutered the entire Republican leadership, captured the command of the Senate, used the appointment of lapdog attorney general to politicize the Department of Justice, selected a record number of conservative judges, and created the most conservative Supreme Court in history, hollowed out some of the consequential departments and agencies of government, politicized the intelligence community, and illegally fired important inspector generals throughout the bureaucracy. In crossing swords with the U.S. military, however, he has alienated some segments of the conservative community and has finally alerted the entire country to the political threat that he represents to U.S. government and even democracy. Welcome to the program, Mel Goodman. So you really think that this is maybe the last straw after listing all those things that you listed in that powerful paragraph?
Well, I think this is more of a prayer than a prophecy, and it's almost a last gasp when you realize what he's done to all of the Democratic guardrails. And when you go back to the book the two Harvard professors wrote a couple of years ago about how democracies die, they die from within. These are leaders who've been elected. Adolf Hitler was elected in 1932. I don't know what we were doing when we elected Donald Trump in 2016, but I always argue that countries get the people they want and deserve. Now I think we know what this man is capable of. But if we don't understand this, as Adam Schiff said when he wound up the impeachment hearings, if right doesn't matter, we're lost. And if truth doesn't matter, we're lost. And not even the founding fathers could save us. So now we're in the ironic situation of the military class possibly saving us. I think the founding fathers would have been flabbergasted by this. One of the things they tried to do in creating our democratic republic, emphasis on republic, was to make sure the civilians controlled the military class. And remember, Trump started out by bringing all these generals in. I was critical of that, but then it turns out we called the generals the adults in the room. Then one by one, these adults were either fired or, in the case of James Mattis, resigned. And then you had the horror of what happened in front of St. John's Episcopal Church on June 1st, this blasphemous image, which I thought was a fascist image, of Trump holding a Bible upside down and backwards in front of St. John's Episcopal. With him in that lineup was the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who referred to American cities as the battle space when he was justifying the deployment of military power. And the man who wouldn't join the photograph was, of course, General Mark Milley, who was at the White House in combat fatigues. Four-star generals don't go to the White House in combat fatigues. He can't claim he didn't know why he was being asked to come to the White House. He was used. He was part of the photo op. He didn't stand in front of the church. And later, after there was tremendous pushback by retired generals, including former students of mine who became chairman of the Joint Chiefs, these were students of the National War College, Martin Dempsey and Mike Mullen. Then you have Colin Powell weighed in. You had various generals and admirals, including Admiral Stavridis, the former head of NATO, who was another former student of mine, weigh in. Then Milley apologized to the graduating class of my former institution, the National War College, realizing what a mistake he made. That was a tremendously courageous act on the part of Milley. The idea of a chairman of the Joint Chiefs apologizing to the graduating students of the National War College, who are all looking to become general officers themselves. The War College is a finishing school, essentially, for high-ranking officers. I think this was the signal that this country is in a lot of trouble, and I'm not sure the country is even keeping up to date with this. What Trump has done behind the pandemic is to continue to compromise the democracy, continue to end regulations, continue to end the environmental restrictions that Obama put in place. And then he goes to the West Point, and it was interesting when he gave that graduating speech at West Point, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs didn't go along as he usually does. The Secretary of Defense, Esper, didn't go along as he usually does. And then he tells the usual lies, talking about the $2 trillion in defense spending he added to the budget. No, he didn't add that budget. These were the old figures that were given incremental increases. He talked about ending endless wars. We have more troops in Afghanistan now than when he came into political office in 2017. We have a few more troops in Syria than when he came in. We have probably the same number in Iraq. He hasn't ended anything. So when you look at the fact that we are facing an election in November and you see the voter repression has already started, I think if the Wisconsin primary and then Georgian primaries weren't wake-up calls, I don't know what Trump has to do to kill these guardrails before the country, which I think has been AWOL, clearly asleep at the switch, begins to react to these authoritarian moves. Remember, he's an authoritarian leader who will appoint generals that suited his authoritarian personality. And one by one, whether it was John Kelly or whether it was H.R. McMaster or it was James Mattis, one by one, they left and have all spoken out against this president. So these are terrible times, and I hope people are aware of it.
Do you think Milley would have responded without all the other generals and everyone else speaking out? I mean, you said he didn't go with him to the church, but he did show up in his fatigues. He claims ignorance. He claims he didn't have time to change. He's got all this other stuff. I'm trying to figure out whether it's within his DNA to understand how far this president had dragged him, or whether he really did need these other people to support him to realize that he needed to step up to the moment, not because necessarily he had the spine to do it, but every military person he respected was looking at him going, What kind of a pawn are you?
Oh, I think he was terribly embarrassed. You know, without that criticism, without that pressure from the retired generals, I think Milley would have just sort of waited out this thunderstorm that he contributed to. And again, the combat fatigues gave it away. That's not how four-star generals go to the White House. That is unheard of. And when you throw in the Mark Esper comments about battle space, and then that the image that really got me, because we've all grown up on Apocalypse Now, and the image of the helicopter in Vietnam using its downdraft to chase away protesters, that's what helicopters are used for in areas of insurgency. That's what we did against ISIS in Iraq. Think of the danger that could have really ensued around Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C. because of this misuse of helicopters by the National Guard. And we still can't find out who gave the order.
I have a couple of questions, though, because I have a couple of things that are like racing through my head. And when you mentioned about the helicopters, that's when things started to come back. Am I correct in understanding that at one point in time in Afghanistan, the vast majority of people that were serving in Afghanistan were the weekend warriors, were in fact the National Guard? It wasn't the U.S. military per se, it was the National Guard that was serving in Afghanistan. When I heard about the National Guard using these helicopter techniques, they had developed those techniques in Afghanistan.
Yeah, these are anti-insurgency techniques.
Yes. I mean, it's just shocking. And then one other thing before we continue the conversation is that the other thing that was so interesting about what happened in D.C. was that in Lafayette Square was that there were all these unidentified people that didn't identify as police, didn't identify as U.S. military, but were clearly there, you know, in some kind of a uniform, carrying weapons, you know, basically look like they're armed and ready to somehow protect the president and the White House. Who the frick were they, Mel? And look, where do we have people who are unidentified in any capacity in the United States?
They were from the Bureau of Prisons. They were from the Drug Enforcement Agency. They're from every national security agency that allows its personnel or its officers to be armed. And I go back to the 1990s when Bill Clinton was pursuing a law of order strategy, and you essentially had the militarization of our police departments. Look at the equipment. If you go into Washington, D.C., you see the incredible armored personnel carriers and huge platforms that are blocking city streets. And some of this equipment belonged to the police department. Now, the Washington, D.C. Police Department and the mayor handle themselves very well. But you have these militarized police departments, which culminated with, you know, again, the George Floyd video, to me, is a direct result of this militarization. You know, what's happening to people of color on the streets is because you have a militarized police department that's no longer walking the streets. These aren't neighborhood police. These aren't community police. These are people now, or police who are in squad cars or armored type vehicles that are essentially occupying the inner cities of places like Baltimore and Minneapolis and Seattle and elsewhere. And unless we cope with the cultural aspects, and when you look at what Donald Trump said yesterday in the Rose Garden about reform, it didn't even begin to touch on the problem. Senator Booker, I think, said it so well in terms it's the culture that has to change. And you can't do that with a piece of legislation or an executive order. It's a new way of thinking about police and the role of the police. And let's face it, the Trump White House and the Republican Party is not up to such a task.
So Cohen has a new book out, and I believe I was listening to him on the air this morning on MSNBC. He was talking about his experience working for different administrations. And one of the things he said, which is so interesting, because in a lot of ways it's the parallel to what we're seeing now with the police and what's happening with Black Lives Matter. And he was talking about Afghanistan. And he said, the problem in Afghanistan is we may have had a military reason for being there, but then we wanted to stay there, that somehow the military would be responsible for helping to establish democratic institutions. You know, it wasn't just about ISIS, that we would be able to somehow help them move from where they were to something that looked more like a mini U.S. And he's like, the military isn't good at that. They can't do that.
We always tell the American people we're there to enhance democracy. That's how you get the American people to support whatever we're trying to do. Woodrow Wilson said that in terms of keeping democracy alive. That was what World War I was all about. We stayed there for one stupid reason. We equated the Taliban with Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
Al-Qaeda in 2 months. And we should have left the country by the winter.
Right.
In October, we could have left in December or January of 2002. But instead, we were going to fight a war with the Taliban. And in the process, we created the Mujahideen. We supported these Islamic fundamentalists. And now they are the major components of the Taliban, who are on the verge of victory finally in Afghanistan because they were willing to wait us out over 20 years of warfare, the longest war in America's history, where we had no interest at stake whatsoever. And it was because George W. Bush thought we could defeat the Taliban and do things that his father couldn't do. We stayed around for two decades with all of the loss of blood and treasure that ensued from that. But it has nothing to do with democracy or nation building. This is just cover.
But now the reason I even bring it up is I'm listening to him this morning. I am thinking about the police and what's happening, especially in American cities, and the lack of trust. And this idea that if there's a problem, you send in the police, whether it's a domestic violence problem, whether it's an overdose, whether it's something that happens in a school. And I'm thinking, once again, we are having a military response or a police response to something that is incapable of solving what is an underlying problem. And if you come in with a military response, the only thing they know how to do really well is use your weapons. But they don't know how to create a democratic institution, social services, a safety net, any of those things in Afghanistan any more than the police know how to do that in American cities. So it's ironic because it's exactly the same problem, Mel. But part of it is that we like these solutions because the other solutions are a little more amorphous. The other solutions aren't a switch. The other solutions don't support the military-industrial complex. And we see the military not just as a military, but as a jobs program. Well, I don't want that job anymore because all it's doing is creating more havoc as a result.
Well, part of the problem is indeed the police culture, and that's the militarized culture. And we saw that played out in Atlanta. The sad thing about the killing of Rayshard in Atlanta was they were having a civil conversation for 20 or 30 minutes. He wasn't a threat to anybody, and he said, his sister lives a few blocks away, just let me walk home. They had his car, they had his identification. They didn't have to create a confrontation, which they did by trying to handcuff him, which sent him into an incredible panic for good reason when you realize what's happened to blacks at the hands of white police officers. But the other problem is we've kicked things in the direction of the police department. The problem of the homeless, we've allowed the police department to deal with that. The way we jail people for modest drug use, we've allowed the police to deal with the problem of marijuana in American cities and social problems in American cities. We've created this problem and we're going to have to correct it, but it's going to have to be the people who are going to have to participate. It's what the Founding Fathers said 200 years ago. If you don't participate, and Benjamin Franklin specifically warned about that, and that's where we are right now.
As I'm thinking about this, the title of the piece, A Counterpunch, is Donald Trump Finally Caught Crossing a Red Line. Obviously, we've begun to see this, and I think you're absolutely right. The fact that Donald Trump was all alone when he went down to give the speech at West Point should tell you everything. Right now, I think the military almost sees him as nuclear waste. Like, you know, just stay away from him because everything he touches turns to rot, and that includes the military. What is so shocking is that this is probably one of the last institutions that people still kind of respect, that people still kind of trust. How does this storyline of crossing this red line play out with not only Donald Trump's base, but with Republicans in Congress, with Republicans in the United States Senate? Aren't they slightly terrified? I mean, how does Lindsey Graham sleep?
Well, Lindsey Graham will not be terrified unless Jamie Harrison wins an election in Carolina. If people don't get out and vote and send a message, and the encouraging thing about Georgia, it's the highest primary vote, highest turnout they've ever had in history, and people braved the coronavirus vote in Georgia and stood in these ridiculously long lines, which is another way to thwart democracy, make sure it takes 3 to 4 hours to have to even cast a vote. This is what we really have to concern ourselves with. And we have to stop thinking about Russian hacking and Russian propaganda and what Putin may be doing to our democracy. It's what Pogo said. We've met the enemy and he is us. It's time for us to do something about it.
You talked about the generals, and in some ways it's so shocking that they're the ones that are saving our democratic institutions. And that was never part of the plan. I think you thought the checks and balances would work, but obviously he's hollowed out all the checks and balances. And it turns out that his abuse of the military is what ultimately ends up protecting us. Is the military also sober enough to realize that the term security now has got to be redefined? that security now isn't necessarily something that's in their bailiwick, that this isn't about them, that when you look at environmental consequences because of climate change, when you look at what's happened because of the pandemic, when you look at the unrest in the streets, when you look at what's happened worldwide, they get it. Do they get it that a bloated military budget that's like the Pac-Man of virtually all our tax revenues, not only is it not solving problems, but it is creating even greater problems, both an instability at the national level, but even an instability at the world level. I don't want to be the world's police. I get it. But at the same time, they're so used to having bigger checks written all the time. Are they prepared to step up and say, stop?
No, they're not prepared at all. Theoretically, they get it, because if you look at military preparedness statements that go to the Congress to justify their budget, they talk about climate change as the chief national security threat. But then when you look at the budget demands, look at the demands now for the Space Force. We don't need a Space Force. We need to demilitarize state. Unfortunately, Obama agreed to get his Strategic Arms Limitation Agreement signed in 2010, which is about to expire in several months. So no, the military is going to continue to ask for more money, for more equipment, for more lethality. And it's lethality, that's the problem of the police department. If you talk to a police officer, and I have, they're trained to shoot to kill. That never should have happened in Atlanta. It wasn't necessary. That kind of lethal force wasn't required. The problem writ large, when you look at the military, is the most lethality. That's why they're against arms control and disarmament, because they want money not to destroy nuclear weapons, but to build more modern nuclear weapons that we don't need. Until we correct this cultural issue about what is the military for, what is the real threat? And the real threat is not the so-called rogue states, the way we've exaggerated Vietnam in its day, or Iraq in its day, or Afghanistan in its day. There were no national security interests at stake for the United States in any of these places. And think of the trillions of dollars. The loss of blood and treasure in these places, it's criminal.
All right, last but not least, there's no G7 meeting, but Donald Trump has said that he's going to remove troops from Germany. Play that one out before you go.
Okay, now there's a slight reason why I don't mind this. You know, a lot of those...
I knew you were going to say this, so that's kind of why I wanted to just sort of touch on it. Keep going.
Oh, troops are in Germany. It's to man very important bases and hospitals and facilities that are take care of our troops that are in the Middle East. My argument is get those troops out of the Middle East, get them out of Afghanistan, get them out of Iraq. Then you wouldn't have that huge air base and hospital at Ramstein. But the way he did it, he didn't consult with the Pentagon. He didn't consult with the National Security Council. He didn't use his national security team. He got pissed off at Angela Merkel, who to me is the leader of the free world. And he said, okay, 10,000 troops. That was aimed at Merkel. Who, like all women everywhere, particularly smart women, just drive him crazy.
Well, you know, the reason I asked you is I knew what your answer was going to be, but this isn't part of a strategy. He's not looking at reducing the footprint in the Middle East. He's just looking at basically saying, screw you to Merkel, basically sort of saying to Putin, winking and nodding, going, look what I'm doing for you. And I mean, in a way, the idea is you like what the potential outcome is, but because there's no underlying policy, Mel, all you have is the worst of everything.
Yeah.
All right.
And that's what he is.
The worst of ever. That's your next piece in Counterpunch. The worst of everything. All right, the title of this piece in Counterpunch, Donald Trump finally caught crossing a red line. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. And you can actually tell he's a former CIA analyst and the father of just so many books. And you're about to write a new one, I guess, called The Dangerous National Security State. Oh, my God, Mel. Take care. Thank you so much for joining us.
Keep up the good work.
I will. Ciao. Bye bye. All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back. And now we're going to talk about the consequences of incarceration and having a criminal record. We'll be right back.
A tiny green insect does major damage on this current cast. Tens of millions of ash trees in the U.S. have fallen victim to an invasive insect called the emerald ash borer. That's not just a problem for forests. Trees are important for water quality.
The roots help control the nitrates and phosphates, which are some of the pollutants that can enter streams and waterways. They also hold the soil in place.
Alicia Trexler of the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy has organized numerous tree plantings in her state. She says she no longer plants ash trees at these events.
I don't want to plant food for bugs.
And she's not alone. Many communities have stopped planting ash and have begun monitoring and management efforts to try to protect existing trees. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2005. That was the day 15 workers were killed and another 170 were seriously injured in an explosion at the BP refinery in Texas City, Texas. Workers were restarting a unit down for repairs. As they filled the tower with gasoline, it overflowed, sending a geyser into the air. The igniting hydrogen vapor cloud created a chain of explosions that destroyed the nearby trailer housing temporary contract workers. The explosion shed light on many key problems throughout the industry. The increasing use of contract workers, safety shortcuts, and qualitative lack of industrial process controls. A 2007 Chemical Safety Board report found that years of cost-cutting, poor worker training, and a safety culture with serious deficiencies left the plant vulnerable to catastrophe, but company leaders ignored the warning signs. OSHA fined BP $21.3 million and more, but ultimately settled for $13 million. For years, the catastrophe was studied closely to eliminate the hazards. But 10 years later, a 2015 joint investigative series by the Texas Tribune and Houston Chronicle found that, quote, "There is little evidence that the 15 lives lost on that March day brought much of anything. The death toll at U.S. refineries has barely slowed. At least 64 energy company employees and contractors were killed in the decade before the blast. At least 58 have died in the 10 years since. The Department of Energy has tracked nearly 350 fires at refineries in the last 8 years, almost one a week. Refinery workers have gone on strike, demanding, among other issues, an increased emphasis on safety. For the United Steelworkers, it is a daily fight to implement the critical safety actions the union developed in the aftermath of the blast."
I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all chains still binding me. Yeah. Wish I could say all the things that I can say when I'm relaxed. I'd be starting anew. I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. Don't leave me. How sweet it would be to find that I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know how it feels to be free. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know how it feels to be free. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Wish I could break all things that bind us apart. Wish you could know what it means to be me. And you'd see, you'd agree, everybody should be free. 'Cause if we ain't, we're murderous. I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be. I could find that I could fly. Soar to the sun. Look down and see. Then I know. Yes, I know. Oh, yeah. It's moving now. but you already know. Jonathan Livingston Seagull ain't got nothing on me.
Welcome back to part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, the Thursday edition. Of course, we're joined with our great producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, where does Arnie go all the time? She goes to theconversation.com. It turns out that theconversation.com is being picked up by newspapers around the country, which is fabulous. In fact, it was picked up, I believe, by the Houston Chronicle, the article that we're about to discuss. So we are completely simpatico right now. And it's not surprising that Houston would want this article given to its readers. The title of the piece, "Being Convicted of a Crime Has Thousands of Consequences Besides Incarceration, and Some Last a Lifetime." We're being joined by Cynthia Kolembeski. She is a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Research Scholar at the School of Law and the School of Public Affairs and Administration at Rutgers University. Your piece, how do I say this? For me, it was not eye-opening because I have been sort of looking at these issues for years. One of the nuggets that I pulled out from your piece, which was just so shocking that I actually even had to post it on my Facebook page because I want to know who counted these. But what was pointed out was that when you look at the consequences of incarceration, you mentioned in your article that there are 44,000. I'm going to remind everyone, there's a comma in this. 44,000 direct and indirect consequences of incarceration, some of which may last a lifetime. And when I looked at that number, I got physically sick because I'm like, oh God, when we decide to arrest someone, do we play out that number as we make that arrest? And then we look at the possible conviction. So I want to welcome you to the program because I think the timing of your piece is so important as we are now sort of having a come to Jesus moment about police misconduct, the abuse of the police, police being sent in for things they should never be sent in, their lack of understanding, the militarization of the police. It's not just that. It's that once the police come in and they've decided that they're going to arrest you, I don't think people quite comprehend what that arrest has in a way of a lifetime effect on an individual. So welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the 77 million adults with criminal records. Just that number alone is staggering when you realize there are 326 million Americans in the United States. That number is, I mean, what is it? One out of every four, one out of every five individuals has a criminal record? What the hell are we doing? I don't feel that anything in our society necessitates that kind of a number.
Right. I would agree with you. And I've seen it cited that it's actually equivalent to the number of U.S. adults with a college education. And so I think that nicely juxtaposes, you know, again, college education will help you. And even that, it's really difficult in this economy and the current state of affairs. But that record, you know, we've seen a lot of amazing research around Ban the Box. And I just want to uplift some scholars, you know, like yourself, that have been advocating for reform and progressive change for years. So, you know, bless her heart, Diva Pager is a sociologist who unfortunately passed away rather young. But she famously did this audit study, and it's the stigma of a criminal record. And so she sent out job applications. She had basically four groups of people. So white men with a conviction, white men, no conviction. Black men with a conviction, black men, no conviction. These were all felony level convictions. So everything else was equivalent, right? Background, education, skills, and employment history. And what she found, which she didn't really know would be the finding, is that white men with a criminal conviction had an easier time getting a job than an African-American male without any conviction. And why I bring that up is because there's also some research around ban the box policies and how they might sort of frighten employers to actually shy away from, you know, hiring African-American, Latino folks. And
explain to my audience what ban the box means. You and I know because it's a term of art that we use. Explain to them what ban the box is. That may be a level of sophistication where we're making assumptions and they don't understand.
Yeah, perfect. So with that example and the part of DiviPedra's study, we see there's literally a box there. You check it. And a lot of us have seen this throughout our life, right? Have you ever been convicted of a felony level crime? Or there might even be a question more generally about any sort of criminal activity or arrest, right, for that matter. And so we see this can really stop one in their tracks. And I guess what I wanted to bring up now, and again, you see this as no big surprise, is what all of these really drive home is that, you know what, some people coming out of prison, they can really handle that they can't get the license to be an HVAC, so that would be like the air conditioner installer, or a barber at their brother's barbershop, or a beautician at their mom's nail salon. As we know, for some folks, there aren't as many job opportunities or, you know, these networks. Again, it's going to be our most poor, and again, disproportionately similar with what's happening with police, as well as the criminal justice system overall, you know, our populations of color are most adversely affected. And it starts very early, right, with education, with policing. And then as you point out, you know, with who gets arrested and who might get a pass.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, Cynthia, there's a couple of stories I want to share with you because I read your article. We were talking about defund the police and the whole issue. But of course, the idea of the effective incarceration really has to be tied hand in hand. We can't talk about the police without talking about the consequences. What happens after you're arrested? Because it's about why am I being arrested? Okay. There was a story that I told that was from the late 1980s, early 1990s. I'm at an event with a bunch of state legislators, and I believe it was the majority leader of the Illinois House of Representatives. And we were talking about criminal justice. And he said that in his state, here's how they plan future prison beds. They go into the second grade class and they count the number of children at risk. They're seven. Wow. They are planning. It's like they've abandoned them at seven. They've decided, we know they're going to have a life of crime. Let's plan our future prison beds. So instead of making investments at seven, they basically wash their hands and say, okay, we're going to incarcerate them instead. That to me is one of the most shocking stories. It changed my life, okay? Because I wasn't thinking I would be focusing in part on these issues. How do you not? Okay, that's one. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is, again, talking about the effect of incarceration. And you just pointed out that study that a Black man without a record has less likelihood of getting a job as a white man with a record. So we already know there's a color code here. Hmm. But here's the other thing. We're looking at a lot of states that are beginning to legalize things like marijuana. We realize that maybe the war on drugs, we've lost the war. And we're seeing a whole shift. But before that, here was the problem. In the state of Massachusetts, I covered them as they went through the decriminalization of marijuana, then they passed the marijuana laws, and then they now can sell marijuana. So I watched this sort of incredible, interesting arc. What was fascinating to me was when they did a referendum on, I believe it was the decriminalization of marijuana, there wasn't one political official that supported it, not one, okay? It passed overwhelmingly, but not one public official. But here's the kicker that goes directly to your article, Cynthia. What did these public officials say? They talked about the fact that they had smoked dope or they had done something. And they understood that it was such a negative consequence that they didn't want other people to do it. And what was so surprising to me is, did they realize that they were attorneys? Did they realize that they were prosecutors? And that more likely they were white? And the reason why they were never arrested or never got caught is because of the color of their skin and their privilege? But the person that did get caught, who did exactly what they did, who was a prosecutor or an attorney, happened to be a person of color. So right. I think these stories that you write and the consequences are so important because I don't think people understand.
Yeah, I think you're so right on and it's very powerful. And so even when we think about housing, you know, New York City is a very progressive area. And, you know, the New York City Housing Authority is one of the biggest public housing authorities, you know, in the nation. We do see people are conflicted. You don't want folks with certain criminal histories or types of behavior that could be potentially harmful, you know, living with you. But there are a lot of folks you know, as you point out too, that do get arrested or even get convicted. And we know some people, again, more often than not, people of color might plea, just because if they plea and get that deal, it will prevent them from a longer sentence if again, they think the justice system is already stacked against them. You know, I'm a young Black guy. They said I had this on me, or, you know, I was with my friend doing something totally different. So we do know some people that aren't even, you know, quote unquote, guilty, do get convictions. But then even folks that are doing something, like you said, you know, we all make bad choices. And again, those consequences can deny people from coming home to their wife, their children, their, you know, their mother. And that might be the only place they have. It's interesting too, because now New York City Housing Authority is implementing a pilot program with Vera Institute for Justice to do just that, help to reunite families. And, you know, I hope this goes really well. And I think just very quickly, what you highlight too, is there's a lot of change underway. And I think people are just really hoping that these small pilot studies or these little cases where a state or a city does something to prevent this sort of discrimination and stigma, you know, that it works out well. So then the other places will see, okay, you know what, we, like you said, we were too punitive, or, you know what, we wrote off these people as criminals, you know, after just one offense and didn't give them a fair chance like we would want.
Well, I mentioned there were 44,000 direct or indirect consequences to having a criminal record. So let's talk about some of the big ones. I'm going to blame Bill Clinton for a lot of this because I'm still angry at him. Anyway, let's look at public benefits like food stamps, you know, the SNAP program. One of the things I thought was fascinating was that they decided that anyone with a drug record could not collect food stamps. And the idea is that they could not collect these kinds of public benefits. So you and I both know that you're leaving jail, you've served your time, you've done what you're supposed to do, now you want to be reintroduced to society. So if it's tough to find a job, if it's tough to find housing, what do you do about eating? I am looking at some of the things they decided to do as all the boxes that the politicians checked to continue to hurt these people. In fact, in a bizarre way, they're out, but they're not out. They're being sort of reincarcerated outside the prison because of all the limitations that are being placed on them. What the hell were people thinking if they want them to get back into society and yet they put every kind of barrier for them to be able to have to climb over in order to do it? Instead of building bridges, they're building walls.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't really say it any better. And I agree with you. You know, there's a lot of political pressure. We can try to forgive the Clintons, but we know that that time in the mid-90s, there was such movement towards this, you know, what they call welfare reform. And again, it was really about punishing the poor. And, you know, it's interesting that you bring up SNAP because, again, you know, food is just a basic necessity. And the conditions in prison, as we could imagine, are very stressful, to say the least, very trauma-inducing. There are some studies that actually suggest one may leave prison or jail with worse health conditions than one entered. And then conversely, as complicated as our world is, sometimes folks that have had such poor healthcare access in the greater community might receive their first real healthcare in the jail or prison. So there is sort of this paradox, but bringing it back to SNAP, I think, you know, we really have to think about how it's exactly what you say. We don't let people sign up for these benefits when they're leaving jail or prison often. And so, you know, all that bureaucracy and the administrative burden and maybe not having the proper ID or having the ID that's actually tying you to the correctional facility, right, as your prisoner ID. So I just think it just sets off a chain of, you know, real difficulty and hardship. And again, that stigma of being reminded who you are and that you're really not a valued citizen, as you suggest, after we've done our time or, you know, we've paid these fines and fees that also follow us around. So it's literally, you know, preventing someone from eating healthy. You know, how are you going to expect them to have a chance in society and not really thrive, but just, you know, basically survive?
I want to just focus in on this because I just think people don't understand that you are setting them up to fail. You are setting them up. If they can't eat and they can't find housing and they can't get a license and they can't do this, how do they make it? Mm-hmm. You couldn't make it. Mm-mm. And yet these people come with all this baggage and all this lack of sort of support. And then you throw them into a system that is not only not supportive, but has so many barriers. You write in your piece, and we'll go back to the Clintons one. In the mid-1990s, Congress and President Bill Clinton endorsed a move by states to stop providing supplemental nutritious assistance program benefits to anyone with drug-related felony convictions. The SNAP restrictions in place today vary and number over 100 nationwide, including 7 imposed by the federal government. Now, this is just the South Carolina story. South Carolina imposes a lifetime ban on SNAP benefits due to drug-related felony convictions. Michigan and 4 other states permanently deny anyone with 2 or more felony drug convictions SNAP benefits. Many states have eased their restrictions in recent years, but Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf recently signed a bill banning those with felony drug convictions and some convicted as sex offenders from receiving public benefits for 10 years. I am looking at this, and then I want to touch on something else that you wrote about, and that is to you see this just basket full of stuff that is denied them as they come out, even though they've served their time. But now, talk to my audience, Cynthia, about the pandemic. Because what we know is that prison places are not exactly a place where you can socially distance. Prisons are not a place where you can wash your hands 25 times a day. They don't usually give you a mask in prison. And we've seen a huge spike in COVID-19 in prisons. As a result, a lot of prisons are beginning to say, okay, we're gonna let people out early. Well, wait a minute, how do you let people out early if what you're letting them out to is not a place to live, is not a place to get public benefits, is not a way to eat, is not a way to find a job? I mean, it's great that you're taking them out of the prison, but what are you doing by dumping them in society with all these barriers to being able to sort of finally begin to participate in a relatively normal way during a pandemic?
Right. I think the points you raise again are excellent. So we saw the latest New York Times figure was about 68,000 folks that have been infected. It's interesting because in the article that you referenced, we saw even Kentucky, where it might not be as progressive as some other states, has reduced its jail population by 32% since March. And the state prison populations, which are slower to be released, has decreased by 7% in Kentucky alone. And you're right. In some states, you know, like bless Governor Gavin Newsom in California, you know, he's helping people make sure they have housing, whether it's using hotel rooms that aren't being used. But again, what people are asking, as you are, is, okay, what's the permanency of this? And, you know, what about in these places where people aren't getting anything and they are entering a depressed economy? And as you said, a state of a pandemic where it's just not a wonderful set of social conditions to be released into. You know, with the trauma of what's been raised, you know, in terms of policing and community relations. So I think to leave these folks exposed in our current state is, you know, it's cruel, as you imply.
But it's more than cruel. I would love, I don't know whether you can do it or we can find someone, I would love an investigative reporter to follow 30 people that have been released from prison, okay? And follow what happens to them once they're released. Because as you mentioned, you know, if they can't get SNAP benefits and they can't get housing and they can't get a license and they can't get this and they can't rejoin their family because their family's in some sort of, you know, government housing or Section 8 housing or some kind of, because they're barred because of their conviction. I would love to have someone follow them to realize what happened once they left prison. Because I think we have to understand that we may have unloaded them from the numbers of people that are COVID-19 positive in prison. But what we've done is we've kind of thrown them into a landscape where they have nowhere to go. They have no support system. They may, in fact, have COVID-19. They may get COVID-19, but because there isn't a support system to assist them, because they, in fact, are a carrier of COVID-19, it's a greater negative in some ways than as if they had stayed in prison, because what are they doing with no support?
Right. One interesting aspect I just want to underscore is, you know, there are people working for the positive change you suggest and really bringing this to the fore. And a lot of them are actually medical health professionals who worked in the prisons. So you might know about Homer Venters, who wrote a book, Life and Death in Rikers. There's Bree Williams out in University of California, San Francisco. She works mostly with aging and elderly populations. So we've locked up people. We had these mandatory minimum sentences, which sounded great. California, 3 strikes, you're out. Okay, they're off the streets. But wait a minute, now we have this crisis and this population exploding inside. And you're right. And then even aging folks that might receive compassionate release, which is technically like, okay, we can let them out because they're quote unquote not a threat anymore. but are we giving them access to the housing and supportive services that they need? And I think this just is hitting everyone. Like you suggest, and what I want to really drive home is, it's really intimidating to be involved with the criminal legal system. You know, everything from that police encounter to the arrest, the individuals and the institutions involved, it's no fun. It's very stressful, if not traumatizing. And then, you know, the judge and the courts, you might have an attorney that's helpful, you might not. But what's striking about this, and I really want to uplift how the Commission on Civil Rights, which is a bipartisan panel reporting to Congress, they did decide to look carefully into these collateral consequences. And they even decided that if they do not serve a public safety or have no rational relationship to the offense committed and block people convicted of crimes from safely reentering and having that capacity to be a contributing member of society, that we should do away with them. And again, I feel like this is this moment, right? People are being flexible. They're making SNAP benefits available without you or me coming in for an interview, right? Because we were social distancing. And so why can't we just really take a critical look? And as you say, take away these barriers, take away these blocks, these punishments, whether they're invisible or not, and really support everyone, you know, and having a fair chance. And I just want to say the one thing that really bothers me is you don't know about these often until you serve your time. There's one woman, bless her, you know, she had a drug addiction. And so she ended up doing time. She spent 2.5 years with limited means training to be a counselor, only to find out that she was barred from that particular license. And now who isn't best poised to help others struggling with addiction than someone that's made it through the other side?
And I think there's a lot of movement now to address police misconduct. And there is a lot of conversation because of Black Lives Matter about sort of the gestalt of racial injustice. This story here is also about racial injustice. You know that as well as I do. And I am just hoping this piece becomes part of the conversation as we move forward. We have to look at the underlying conditions, you know, the lack of access to healthcare, the lack of increase in minimum wage, the kind of lack of jobs, the lack of housing, you know, all these things. These are our historic mistakes, which is why there are 77 million people now with criminal convictions. Is it really because they should have been convicted of a crime? Is it because everyone, including the policeman, has what we call prosecutorial discretion? So if they saw me doing something, I'd get a pat on the head being told, no, 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 Arnie, you shouldn't be doing this. Now, I'm a white woman. Yet if I had been a black woman or a black man, would they have like put me in the police car and sent me off to be booked? I mean, that's part of the problem too. So when you also look back at that 77 million and you realize the racial implication for why some people are, you know, accused of a crime or convicted of a crime, we almost have an obligation to make sure that these 77 million, those barriers are addressed, many of them are removed. And that what we really do is, if they have served the time, whether they deserve to get the time or not, that we make sure that they can really become full functioning members of society. And the part that I loved the best was, which state in the nation has fewer barriers for people that have criminal convictions? It's the state of Vermont. Oh my God, Cynthia, when I read that, I'm going, and of course, because if you're in prison, you can vote in Vermont. They realize you're still human beings, but in other states, for whatever reason, some of your humanity is taken away from you.
Yeah. And can we just lift up that number? So yes, you're right. It's 319 in Vermont, which also has a lower incarceration rate in general. And let's be honest, Vermont is a little more of a white state, right, than other places with less stratification. And we know where there's a lot of racial segregation, that's where we see a lot of this tension. And I think, again, like this violence, whether it's explicit or structural. And then so for 319 in Vermont, we go to 2,388 in Louisiana. And again, Louisiana, very problematic practices around prisons, jails, policing. And again, just that history of racial segregation as well as strife. And I hope we can repair. And really, like, what I love about your work too is just that we can listen and talk with one another, right, and really just see what is helpful and what is hurtful. And again, I agree with you. We've done the time. There's fines and fees that, you know, again, are giving money to the cities or the states. And then there's these collateral consequences. And how can someone ever get through this?
You know, I always say that all politicians should file two statements: a personal financial statement and a personal failure statement. And it would be very interesting to see what was in their personal failure statement. because if they had been a person of color, might they have been convicted? Uh-huh. And on that note, being convicted of a crime has thousands of consequences besides incarceration, and some last a lifetime. This will be posted at theconversation.com. It's posted on my website. I believe the Houston Chronicle picked up your story. Congratulations, Mazel Tov. Cynthia Golembeski, thank you so much for joining us. And Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Research Fellow, they are lucky to have you.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure, and I really admire your work. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much. All right, everyone. We will schmooze tomorrow. This is a Thursday edition of the Attitude Chat. You better think.